He has illegals as well who report to him, of course. We know two of them, both covered as businessmen, who do real business in addition to espionage. We've been building up this book for some time. In any case, Vanya is a competent, capable chap. He's covered as the embassy's third secretary, does his diplomatic duties like a genuine diplomat, and is well-liked by the people with whom he comes into contact. Bright, witty, good chap to have a pint with. Drinks beer more than vodka, oddly enough. He seems to like it in London. Married, two children, no bad habits that have come to our attention. His wife doesn't work at all, but we haven't seen anything covert on her part, just a housewife so far as we can discern. Also well-liked in the diplomatic community. Holt passed across photographs of both. Now, he went on, just yesterday our friend was having a friendly pint in his favourite pub. It's a few blocks from the embassy in Kensington, close to the palace. The embassy dates back to the Tsars, just like the one you have in Washington. And this pub is rather upscale. Here's the enhanced photo of the chap he had his beer with. Another photo was passed across. The face, Clark and Tawny saw, was grossly ordinary. The man had brown hair and eyes, regular features, and was about as distinctive as a steel garbage can in an alley. In the photo he was dressed in jacket and tie. The expression on his face was unremarkable. They might have been discussing football, the weather, or how to kill someone they both didn't like. There was no telling.
"I don't suppose he has a regular seat," Tawny asked.
"No, usually sits at the bar, but sometimes in a booth, and rarely in the same seat twice in a row. We've thought about placing a bug," Holt told them. "But it's technically difficult. It would let the publican know we're up to something, and it's very doubtful that we'd get anything useful from it. His English is superb, by the way. The publican seems to think he's a Briton from the North Country."
"Does he know you're following him?" Tawny asked, before Clark could.
Holt shook his head. "Hard to say, but we do not think so. The surveillance teams switch off, and they're some of my best people. They go to this pub regularly, even when he's not there, in case he has a chap of his own there to do counter-surveillance. The buildings in the area allow us to track him fairly easily by camera. We've seen a few possible brush passes, but you both know the drill on that. We all bump into people on a crowded sidewalk, don't we?"
"They're not all brush passes.
That's why we teach our field officers to do it. Especially when the streets are crowded, you can have a dozen cameras on your subject and not see it being done."
Clark and Tawny both nodded at that. The brush pass had probably been around as long as spies had. You walked down a street, and at most you pretended to bump into someone. In the process, his hand delivered something into yours, or dropped it in your pocket. And with minimal practice, it was virtually invisible even to people watching for it. To be successful, only one of the parties had to wear something distinctive, and that could be a carnation in your buttonhole, the color of a necktie, or the way one carried a newspaper, or sunglasses, or any number of other markers known only to the participants in the mini-operation. It was the simplest of examples of field craft, the easiest to use, and for that reason the curse of counter-espionage agencies. But if he did a pass to this pop-off guy, they had a photograph of the bastard. Maybe had it, he reminded himself. There was no guarantee that the guy he'd drunk with yesterday was the right fellow. Maybe Kirilenko was swift enough that he'd go to a pub and strike up a conversation with some other patron just to piss the five people off, and give them another randomly selected person to check out. Doing that required personnel and time, neither of which the security service had in infinite quantities. Espionage and counter-espionage remained the best damned game in town, and even the players themselves never really knew what the score was. "So, you'll increase your coverage of Kirilenko?" Bill Tawny asked.
"Yes," Holt nodded.
But do remember, we're up against a highly skilled player. There are no guarantees.
I know that, Mr. Holt. I've been in the field, and the second chief directorate never got their hands on me, Clark told the visitor from the security service.
So, anything at all on Popoff?
He shook his head. That name is not in our files. It's possible, I suppose, that we have him under another name. Perhaps he's been in contact with our PIRA friends. That actually seems likely, if he's a terrorism specialist. There were many such contacts. We've got informers inside the PIRA, and I'm thinking about showing the photograph to some of them. But that's something we have to do carefully. Some of our informers are doubles. Our Irish friends have their own counter-espionage operations, remember?
I've never worked directly against them, John said next. How good are they?
Bloody good, Holt assured him, catching a nod also from Bill Tawney. They are highly dedicated and superbly organized, but now the organization's fragmenting somewhat. Obviously, some of them do not want peace to break out. Our good friend Jerry Adams is by profession a publican, and if the troubles come to an end, and he fails to get himself elected to high public office, as he clearly hopes, then his fallback job is rather lower in prestige than the position he now holds. But the majority of them seem willing to terminate their operations, declare victory, and give peace a chance. That has helped our informer recruiting somewhat, but there are elements of the PIRA who are more militant today than they were 10 years ago. It's a cause for concern, Holt told them.
Same story in the Bekaa Valley, Clark agreed.
What did you do when Satan came to Jesus? Some would never want to stop fighting sin. And if that meant creating some sin themselves, well, that was just the cost of doing business, wasn't it?
They just don't want to let go.
Well, that is a problem. And I need not tell you that one of the main targets of those chaps is right here. The SAS is not exactly beloved of the PIRA.
That wasn't news either.
The British Special Air Service Commandos had gone into the field often enough to sort out IRA members who had made the two serious mistakes of breaking the law and being known. John thought it a mistake to use soldiers to perform what was essentially a police function. But then he had to admit that Rainbow was tasked to that exact mission, in a manner of speaking. But the SAS had done things that in some contexts could be called premeditated murder. Britain, much as it resembled America in so many ways, was a different country with different laws and very different rules in some areas. So security at Hereford was tight, because someday 10 or so bad guys might appear with AK-47s and an attitude, and his people, like many of the resident SAS troops, had families, and terrorists didn't always respect the rights of non-combatants, did they?
Not hardly.
The decision had come with unusual speed from No. 2 Dzerzhinsky Square, and a courier was now on his way. Kirilenko was surprised to get the coded message. The courier was flying Aeroflot to Heathrow with a diplomatic bag, which was inviolable so long as the courier kept it in his possession. Countries had been known to steal them for their contents, which were often uncoded. But couriers knew about that, and played by a strict set of rules. If they had to visit the can, so did the bag. And so, with their diplomatic passports, they breezed through control points and went off to the waiting cars that were always there, carrying the usually canvas bags, often full of valuable secrets, past the eyes of people who would trade their daughter's virtue for one look. So it happened here. The courier arrived on the evening flight from Moscow's Sheremetyevo International, was waved through customs, and hopped into the waiting car driven by an embassy employee. From there it was a mere 40 minutes through rush-hour traffic to Kensington, and from there to Kirilenko's office. The manila envelope was sealed with wax to ensure that it hadn't been tampered with. The resident thanked the courier for this, and two other packages, and went to work. It was late enough that he'd have to pass on his usual pint of bitter tonight, It was an annoyance to him. He honestly enjoyed the atmosphere of his favorite pub. There was nothing like it in Moscow, or any of the other countries he'd served in. So now, in his hands, was the complete dossier on Clark John T., senior CIA field officer. It ran to 20 single-spaced pages, plus 3 photographs. He took the time to read the package over. It was impressive. According to this, in his first and only meeting with Chairman Golovko, he'd admitted to smuggling the wife and daughter of former KGB Chairman Gerasimov right out of the country. Using a submarine to do it? So, the story he'd read in the Western media was true? It was like something from Hollywood. Then later, he'd operated in Romania around the time of Nicolae Ceausescu's downfall. Then, in cooperation with Station Tokyo, he'd rescued the Japanese Prime Minister. And again, with Russian assistance, participated in the elimination of Mahmoud Haji Daryai? Believed to have the ear of the American president, the analysis page pronounced. And well he should, Kirilenko thought. Sergei Nikolaevich Golovko himself had added his thoughts to the file. A highly competent field officer, an independent thinker, known to take his own initiative on operations, and believed never to have put a foot wrong. Training officer at the CIA Academy in Yorktown, Virginia, believed to have trained both Edward and Mary Patricia Foley, respectively the Director of Central Intelligence and the Deputy Director for Operations. This was one formidable officer, Kirilenko thought. He'd impressed Golovko himself, and few enough Russians accomplished that. So now he was in England somewhere, doing something covert, and his parent agency wanted to know about it, because you tried very hard to keep track of such people. The resident took the paper scrap from his wallet. It looked like a cellular phone number. He had several of those in his desk drawers, all cloned from existing accounts, because it kept his signals people busy, cost the embassy no money, and was very secure. Tapping into a known cellular account was difficult, but absent the electronic codes, it was just one more signal in a city awash in them. Dmitri Arkadyevich had the same thing. In every city in the world were people who cloned phones and sold them illegally on the street. London was no exception.
"Yes," a distant voice said.
"Dmitri, this is Vanya."
"Yes?"
"I have the package you requested. I will require payment in the terms we agreed upon."
"It will be done," Popov promised. "Where can we make the exchange?"
That was easy. Kirilenko proposed the time, place, and method.
"Agreed."
And the connection broke after a mere 70 seconds. Perhaps Popov had been riffed, but he still knew about communications discipline.
Chapter 20. Contacts.
She knew she was sick. She wasn't sure how much, but Mary Bannister knew that she didn't feel well. And, through the drugs, part of her worried that it might be serious. She'd never been in a hospital, except once to the local emergency room for a sprained ankle that her father worried might be broken. But now she was in a hospital-type bed with an IV tree next to her, and a clear plastic line that ran down into the inside of her right arm. And just the sight of it frightened her, despite the drugs going into her system. She wondered what they were giving her. Dr. Kilgore had said fluids to keep her hydrated and some other stuff, hadn't he? She shook her head, trying to get the cobwebs loose enough to remember. Well, why not find out? She swung her legs to the right and stood, badly and shakily, then bent down to look at the items hanging on the tree. She had trouble making her eyes focus, and bent closer, only to find that the markings on the tag tapes were coded in a way she didn't understand. Subject F4 stood back up and tried to frown in frustration, but didn't quite make it. She looked around the treatment room.
Another bed was on the far side of what appeared to be a brick partition about 5 feet high, but it was unoccupied. There was a TV, off at the moment, hanging on the far wall. The floor was tile, and cold on her bare feet. The door was wood, and had a latch rather than a knob. It was a standard hospital door, but she didn't know that. No phone anywhere. Didn't hospitals have phones in the room? Was she in a hospital? It looked and seemed like one, but she knew that her brain was working more slowly than usual, though she didn't know how she knew. It was as if she'd had too much to drink. Besides feeling ill, she felt vulnerable, not in total command of herself. It was time to do something, though exactly what, she wasn't sure. She stood there for a brief time to consider it, then took the tree in her right hand and started walking for the door. Fortunately, the electronic control unit on the tree was battery-powered and not plugged into the wall. It rolled easily on the rubber wheels. The door, it turned out, was unlocked. She pulled it open, stuck her head out, and looked around the door frame into the corridor. Empty. She walked out, still dragging the ivy tree behind her. She saw no nurse's station at either end, but did not find that remarkable. Subject F4 headed to her right, pushing the ivy tree ahead of her now, looking for something, she wasn't sure what. She managed a frown and tried other doors, but while they opened, they revealed only darkened rooms, most of them smelling of disinfectant, until she got to the very end. This door was labeled T9, and behind it she found something different. No beds here, but a desk with a computer whose monitor screen was on, meaning that the computer was powered up. She walked in and leaned over the desk. It was an IBM compatible, and she knew how to work those. It even had a modem, she saw. Well, then, she could do what? It took another couple of minutes to decide. She could get a message off to her father, couldn't she? 50 feet and one floor away, Ben Farmer got himself a mug of coffee and sat back down into his swivel chair after a quick trip to the men's room. He picked up the copy of BioWatch he'd been reading. It was 3 in the morning, and all was quiet on his end of the building.
"Daddy, I'm not sure where I am. They say I signed a form, allow them to sign me in for some medical tests, some new drug or something, but I feel pretty crummy now, and I'm not sure why. They have me hooked up to a medication thing that's plugged into my arm. Feel pretty crummy, and I..."
Farmer finished the article on global warming, and then checked the TV display. The computer flipped through the operating cameras, showing all the sickies in their beds. Except one. "Huh?" he thought, waiting for the cameras to flip back, having missed the code number for the one with the empty bed. It took about a minute. Oh, shit, T4 was missing. That was the girl, wasn't it? Subject F4, Mary something. Oh, shit, where had she gone to? He activated the direct controls and checked the corridor. Nobody there either. Nobody had tried to go through the doors into the rest of the complex. They were both locked and alarmed. Where the hell were the docs? The one on duty now was a woman, Lanny something. The other staff all disliked her 'cause she was an arrogant, obnoxious bitch. Evidently, Kilgore didn't like her either, 'cause she always had the night duty. Palachek. That was her last name. Farmer wondered vaguely what nationality that was as he lifted the microphone for the PA system. "Dr. Palachek, Dr. Palachek, please call security," he said over the speaker system. It took about 3 minutes before his phone rang. "This is Dr. Palachek. What is it?" "Subject 4 has taken a walk. I can't spot her on the surveillance cameras." "On the way. Call Dr. Kilgore." "Yes, doctor." Farmer called that number from memory.
Yeah, came the familiar voice. Sir, it's Ben Farmer. F-4 has disappeared from her room. We're looking for her now. Okay, call me back when you find her. And the phone went dead. Kilgore wasn't all that excited. You might be able to walk around for a while, but you couldn't leave the building without someone seeing you. It was still rush hour in London. Ivan Petrovich Kirilenko had an apartment close to the embassy, which allowed him to walk to work. The sidewalks were crowded with rapidly moving people on their way to their own jobs. The Brits are a polite people, but Londoners tend to race along. And he got to the agreed-upon corner at exactly 8:20 a.m. He carried his copy of the Daily Telegraph, a conservative morning newspaper, in his left hand, as he stopped at the corner, waiting for the light to change. The switch was expertly done. No words were exchanged, just a double bump on the elbow to tell him to slacken his grip, to allow one telegraph to be changed for another. It was done below the waist, hidden from the casual view of those around him, and low enough to be hidden by the crowd from cameras that might be looking down from the rooftops around the busy corner. It was all the resident could do not to smile. The exercise of fieldcraft was always a pleasure for him. Despite his currently high rank, he enjoyed the day-to-day business of espionage, just to prove to himself that he could still do it, as well as the youngsters working under him. A few seconds later, the light changed, and a man in a tan coat angled away from him, walking briskly forward with his morning paper. It was two more blocks to the embassy. He walked through the iron gate, into the building, past security, and up to his second-floor office. There, his coat hung on the hook on the back of his door, he sat down and opened the paper on his desk. So Dmitri Arkadyevich had kept his word. There were two sheets of unlined white paper liberally covered with handwritten commentary. CIA Field Officer John Clark was now in Hereford, England, and was now the commander of a new multinational counter-terrorist group known as Rainbow, composed of 10 to 20 men selected from English, American, and perhaps some other nationalities. It was a black operation known only to a handful of highly placed people. His wife was a nurse working at the local public hospital. His team was well regarded by the local civilians who worked on the SAS base. Rainbow had been on three missions, Bern, Vienna, and World Park, where in every case it had dealt with the terrorists. Kirilenko noted that Popov had avoided use of the previous term of art, progressive elements, efficiently, quickly, and under the cover of local police agencies. The Rainbow team had access to American hardware, which had been used in Spain, as was clear from television coverage of the event, which he recommended that the embassy get hold of. Through the defense attaché would probably be best, Popov noted. On the whole, a useful, concise, and informative report, the resident thought, and a fair trade for what he'd exchanged on the street corner.
"Well, see anything this morning?" Cyril Holt asked the head of the surveillance group.
"No," the other five men replied.
He was carrying the usual paper in the usual hand, but the pavement was crowded. There could have been a switch, but if there was, we didn't see it. And we are dealing with a professional, sir," the chief of the surveillance section reminded the deputy director of the security service.
Popov, his brown wide-brimmed hat in his lap, was sitting in the train on the way back to Hereford, seemingly reading the newspaper, but in fact leafing through the photocopies of the single-spaced pages relayed from Moscow. Kirilenko was as good as his word, Dmitri Arkadyevich saw with pleasure, as a good resident should be. And so now here he was, sitting alone in the first-class carriage of the intercity train out of Paddington Station, learning more about this John Clark chap, and impressed with what he saw.
His former agency in Moscow had paid quite a bit of attention to him. There were three photographs, one of them quite good, that appeared to have been shot in the office of the RVS chairman himself in Moscow. They'd even taken the time to learn about his family. Two daughters, one still in college in America, and one a physician now married to Juan Domingo Chavez. Another CIA field officer, Popov saw, in his middle 30s. Domingo Estebanovich, who'd also met Golovko, and was evidently partnered with the older officer. Both were paramilitary officers. Might this Chavez be in England, too? A physician, so that was easily checked. Clark and his diminutive partner were officially described as formidable and experienced field intelligence officers. Both spoke Russian in a manner described as literate and cultured. Graduates of the U.S. military's language school at Monterey, California, no doubt. Chavez, the report went on, had an undergraduate and a master's degree in international relations from George Mason University outside of Washington, doubtless paid for by CIA. So neither he nor Clark was merely a strong back. Both were educated as well. And the younger one was married to a physician. Their known and confirmed field operations, Nichevo, Popov thought, two really impressive ones done with Russian assistance, plus the exfiltration of Gerasimov's wife and daughter 10 years before, along with several others suspected but not confirmed. Formidable was the right word for both of them. Himself a field intelligence officer for over 20 years, he knew what to be impressed with. Clark had to be a star at Langley, and Chavez was evidently his protege, following in the wide, deep footsteps of his father-in-law. Wasn't that interesting? They found her at 3:40, still typing away on the computer, slowly and badly. Ben Farmer opened the door and saw first the IV tree, then the back on the hospital gown. "Well, hello," the security guard said, not unkindly. "Taking a little walk, eh?"
"I wanted to tell Daddy where I was," Mary Bannister replied.
"Oh, really? By email?"
"That's right," she answered pleasantly.
"Well, how about we get you back to your room now, okay?"
"I guess," she agreed tiredly.
Farmer helped her to her feet and walked her out into the corridor, gently, his hand around her waist. It was a short walk, and he opened the door into Treatment 4, got her in bed, and pulled the blanket up. He dimmed the lights before leaving, then found Dr. Palachek walking the halls.
"We may have a problem, Doc."
Lani Palachek didn't like being called Doc, but didn't make an issue of it now.
"What's the problem?"
"I found her on the computer in T9. She says she emailed her father."
"What?"
That popped the doc's eyes open, Farmer saw.
"That's what she said."
"Oh, shit," the doctor thought.
"What does she know?"
"Probably not much. None of them know where they are. And even looking out the windows wouldn't help. The scenery showed only wooded hills. Not even a parking lot whose auto license plates might give a clue. That part of the operation had been carefully thought through."
"Any way to recover the letter she sent?"
"If we get her password and the server she logged into, maybe," Farmer replied. He was fully checked out on computers. Just about everyone in the company was.
"I can try that when we wake her up. Say, in about 4 hours."
"Any way to unsend it?"
Farmer shook his head.
"I doubt it. Not many of them work that way. We don't have AOL software on the systems, just Eudora. And if you execute the immediate send command, it's all the way gone, Doc. That goes right into the net, and once it's there—oh, well.
Kilgore is going to freak.
Yes, ma'am, the former Marine said. Maybe we need to code-word access to the pewters. He didn't add that he'd been off the monitors for a while, and that it was all his fault. Well, he hadn't been briefed on this contingency, and why the hell didn't they lock the rooms they wanted to keep people out of? Or just locked the subjects in their rooms? The winos from the first group of test subjects had spoiled them. None of those street bums had had the ability to use a computer, nor the desire to do much of anything. And it hadn't occurred to anyone that the current group of experimental animals might.
Oops.
Well, he'd seen bigger mistakes than that happen before. The good news, however, was that there was no way they could know where they were, nor anything about the name of the company that owned the facility. Without those things, what could F-4 have told anyone? Nothing of value, Farmer was sure. But she was right about one thing, Farmer knew. Dr. John Kilgore was going to be seriously pissed. The English plowman's lunch was a national institution. Bread, cheese, lettuce, baby tomatoes, chutney, and some meat, turkey in this case, along with a beer, of course. Popoff had found it to be agreeable on his first trip to Britain. He'd taken the time to remove his tie and change into more casual clothes, in order to appear a working-class type.
"Well, hello,"
the plumber said as he sat down. His name was Edward Miles, a tall, powerfully built man with tattoos on his arm, a British affectation, especially for men in uniform, Popoff knew.
"Started ahead of me, I see."
"How did the morning go?"
"The usual. Fixed a water heater in one of the houses, for a French chap, in fact, part of the new team. His wife is a smasher," Miles reported. "Only saw a picture of him. A sergeant in the French army, it would seem."
"Really?"
Popoff took a bite of his open-faced sandwich.
"Yes, have to go back this afternoon to finish up. Then I have a water cooler to fix in the headquarters building. Bloody things must be 50 years old. I may have to make the part I need to repair the damn thing. Impossible to get them. The maker went out of business a dog's age ago."
Miles started on his own lunch, expertly dividing the various ingredients and then piling them on the freshly made bread.
"Government institutions are all the same," Popoff told him.
"That's a fact," Miles agreed. "And my helper called in sick. Sick my ass," the plumber said. "No rest for the bloody wicked."
"Well, perhaps my tools can help," Popoff offered.
They continued talking about sports until lunch was finished, then both stood and walked to Miles's truck, a small blue van with government tags. The Russian tossed his collection of tools in the back. The plumber started it up, pulled onto the road, and headed for the main gate of the Hereford base. The security guard waved them through without a close look.
"See, you just need to know the right bloke to get in here."
Miles laughed at his conquest of base security, which, the sign said, was on black status, the lowest alert state.
"I suppose the IRA chaps have calmed down quite a bit. And it would never have been a good idea to come here, not against these chaps, like tweaking a lion's nose. Bad job, that," he went on.
"I suppose that's so. All I know about the SAS is what I see on the telly. They certainly look like a dangerous lot."
"That's the bloody truth," Miles confirmed. "All you need do is to look at them, the way they walk and such. They know they're lions. And this new lot, they're exactly the same, maybe even better, some folks say. They've had 3 jobs, or so I understand, and they've all been on the telly. They sorted that mob out at World Park for fair, didn't they?"
The base engineer's building was so typical of its type that the ones in the former Soviet Union could hardly have been different. The paint was peeling, and the parking area lumpy and fragmented. The double doors into the back had locks on them, of the type a child could have picked with a hairpin, Popoff thought. But then, the most dangerous weapon in there would have been a screwdriver.
Miles parked his truck and waved for Popoff to follow him. Inside was also as expected. A cheap desk for the plumber to do his paperwork on, a well-worn swivel chair whose stuffing was visible through the cracked vinyl on the seat, and a pegboard hung with tools, few of which could have been younger than 5 years, judging by the chipped paint on the forged steel.
"Do they let you purchase new tools?" Popoff asked, just to stay in character.
"I have to make a request, with justification, to the chief of the physical plant department. He's usually a decent bloke about it, and I don't ask for things I don't need."
Miles pulled a post-it note from his desk.
"They want that water cooler fixed today. Why can't they just drink Coca-Cola?" he wondered aloud. "Well, want to come along?"
"Why not?" Popoff stood and followed him out the door. 5 minutes later, he regretted it. An armed soldier was outside the entrance to headquarters. And then he realized that this was the headquarters for Rainbow. Inside would be Clark, Ivan Timofeyevich himself. Miles parked the truck, got out, walked to the rear door and opened it, pulling out his toolbox.
"I'll need a small pipe wrench," he told Popoff, who opened the canvas sack he'd brought, and extracted a brand-new 12-inch rigid wrench.
"Will this do?"
"Perfect."
Miles waved him along.
"Good afternoon, Corp,"
he said to the soldier, who nodded politely in reply but said nothing. For his part, Popoff was more than surprised. In Russia, the security would have been much tighter. But this was England, and the plumber was doubtless known to the guard. With that, he was inside, trying not to look around too obviously, and exercising all of his self-control not to appear nervous. Miles immediately set to work, unscrewing the front, setting the cover aside, and peering back into the guts of the water cooler. He held his hand out for the small wrench, which Popoff handed to him.
"Nice feel for the adjustment, but it's brand new, so that's to be expected."
He tightened on a pipe and gave the wrench a twist.
"Come on now. There."
He pulled the pipe out and inspected it by holding it up to a light.
"Ah, well, that I can fix. Bloody miracle," he added.
He slid back on his knees and looked in his toolbox.
"The pipe is merely clogged up. Look, must be 30 years of sediment in there."
He handed it over.
Popoff made a show of looking through the pipe, but saw nothing at all. The metal tube was so packed with sediment, he guessed from what Miles had said.
Then the plumber took it back and inserted a small screwdriver, jammed it like the ramrod of a musket to clear it out, then switched ends to do the same from the other direction.
"So we're going to get clean water for our coffee?" a voice asked.
"I expect so, sir," Miles replied.
Popoff looked up and managed to keep his heart beating. It was Clark, Ivan Timofeyevich, as the KGB file had identified him, tall, middle-50s, smiling down at the two workmen, dressed in suit and tie, which somehow looked uncomfortable on him. He nodded politely at the man and looked back down to his tools while thinking as loudly as he could.
"Go away."
"There, that should do it," Miles said, reaching to put the pipe back inside, then taking the wrench from Popoff to screw it into place.
In another moment he stood and turned the plastic handle. The water that came out was dirty.
"We just need to keep this open for 5 minutes or so, sir, to allow the pipe to flush itself out."
"Fair enough."
"Thanks," the American said, then walked off. "A pleasure, sir," Miles said to the disappearing back.
"That was the boss, Mr. Clark."
"Really?"
"Polite enough."
"Yes, decent bloke."
Miles stood and flipped the plastic level. The water coming out of the spigot was clouded at first, but after a few minutes it appeared totally clear.
"Well, that's one job done." "It's a nice wrench," Miles said, handing it back. "What do they cost?"
"This one. It's yours."
"Well, thank you, my friend,"
Miles smiled on his way out the door and passed the corporal of the British Army's military police. Next, they rode around the base. Popoff asked where Clark lived, and Miles obliged by taking a left turn and heading off to the senior officer's quarters.
"Not a bad house, is it?"
"It looks comfortable enough." It was made of brown brick, with what appeared to be a slate roof, and about 100 square meters, and a garden in the back.
"I put the plumbing in that one myself," Miles told him, "back when it was renovated."
"Ah, that must be the missus." A woman came out dressed in a nurse's uniform, walked to the car, and got in. Popoff looked and recorded the image.
"They have a daughter who's a doctor at the same hospital the mum works at," Miles told him. "Bun in the oven for that one. I think she's married to one of the soldiers. Looks just like her mum, tall, blonde, and pretty. Smash her, really."
"Where do they live?"
"Oh, over that way, I think," Miles replied, waving vaguely to the west. "Officer housing, like this one, but smaller."
"So, what can you offer us?" the police superintendent asked. Bill Henriksen liked the Australians. They came right to the point. They were sitting in Canberra, Australia's capital, with the country's most senior cop and some people in military uniforms.
"Well, first of all, you know my background."
He'd already made sure that his FBI experience and the reputation of his company were well known. "You know that I work with the FBI, and sometimes even with Delta at Fort Bragg. Therefore, I have contacts, good ones. And perhaps, in some ways, better than your own," he said, risking a small boast.
"Our own SAS are excellent," the chief told him.
"I know it," Bill responded, with a nod and a smile. "We worked together several times when I was in the hostage rescue team, in Perth twice, Quantico and Fort Bragg once each, back when Brigadier Philip Stocker was the boss." "What's he do now, by the way?"
"Retired 3 years ago, the chief answered.
"Well, Phil knows me. Good man. One of the best I ever met," Henriksen pronounced.
"Anyway, what do I bring to the party?"
"I work with all the hardware suppliers. I can connect you with H&K for the new MP10 that our guys like. It was developed for an FBI requirement, because we decided the 9mm wasn't powerful enough. However, the new Smith & Wesson 10mm cartridge is. It's a whole new world for the H&K weapon. But anyone can get guns for you. I also do business with E-Systems, Collins, Fredericks Anders, Microsystems, Halliday Inc., and all the other electronics companies. I know what's happening in communications and surveillance equipment. Your SAS is weak in that area, according to my contacts. I can help fix that. And I can get you good prices for the equipment you need. In addition, my people can help train you up on the new equipment. I have a team of former Delta and HRT people, mostly NCOs, including the Regimental Sergeant Major from the Special Operations Training Center at Bragg, Dick Voss. He's the best in the world, and he works for me now."
"I've met him," the RCSAS Major noted. "Yes, he's very good indeed."
"So, what can I do for you?" Henriksen asked. "Well, you've all seen the upsurge of terrorist activity in Europe, and that's a threat you need to take seriously for the Olympics. Your SAS people don't need any advice from me or anyone else on tactics, but what my company can do is to get you state-of-the-art electronics gear for surveillance and communication. I know all the people who custom make the gear our guys use. And that stuff your people want to have. I know that. They have to want it."
"Well, I can help you get exactly what you need, and train your troops up on it. There's no other company in the world with our expertise."
The reply was silence. Henriksen could read their minds, however. The terrorism they'd watched on TV, just like everyone else had perked up their ears. It must have. People in this line of work worried for a living, always searched for threats, real and imagined.
The Olympic Games were a catch of immense prestige for their nation, and also the most prestigious terrorist target on the planet, which the German police had learned the hard way at Munich in 1972. In many ways, the Palestinian attack had been the kickoff of the World Terrorist Game, and as a result, the Israeli team was always a little better looked after than any other national collection of athletes, and invariably had some of their own military's commandos tucked in with the wrestlers, generally with the knowledge of the host nation's security people. Nobody wanted Munich to happen again. The recent terrorism incidents in Europe had lit up awareness across the world, but nowhere more seriously than in Australia, a nation with great sensitivity to crime. Not long ago, a madman had shot to death a number of innocent people, including children, which had resulted in the outlawing of guns throughout the country by the parliamentarians in this very city.
"What do you know about the European incidents?" the Aussie SAS officer asked.
Henriksen affected a sensitive look.
"Much of what I know is, well, off the record, if you know what I mean."
"We all have security clearances," the cop told him.
"Okay, but you see, the problem is, I am not cleared into this stuff exactly, and..."
"Oh, what the hell. The team doing the takedowns is called Rainbow. It's a black operation composed mainly of Americans and Brits, but some other NATO nationalities tossed in, too. They're based in UK at Hereford. Their commander is an American CIA type, guy name of John Clark. He's a serious dude, guys, and so's his outfit. Their three known operations went down smooth as a baby's ass. They have access to American equipment, helicopters and such, and they evidently have diplomatic agreements in place to operate all over Europe when the countries with problems invite them in. Has your government talked to anyone about them?"
"We're aware of it," the chief cop replied. "What you said is correct in all details. In honesty, I didn't know the name of the commander.
Anything else you can tell us about him?"
"I've never met the man. Only know him by reputation. He's a very senior field officer, close to the DCI, and I gather that our president knows him personally as well. So you would expect him to have a very good intelligence staff. And, well, his operational people have shown what they can do, haven't they?"
"Bloody right," the major observed.
"The WorldPAC job was as good a bit of sorting out as I've ever seen, even better than the Iranian embassy job in London way back when."
"You could have handled it about the same way," Henriksen observed, generously, and meaning it. The Australian Special Air Service was based on the British model, and while it didn't seem to get much work, the times he'd exercised with them during his FBI career had left him in little doubt as to their abilities.
"Which squadron, Major?"
"First Sabre," the young officer replied.
"I remember Major Bob Fremonton. He's our colonel now," the major informed him.
"Really? I have to keep better track. That's one kick-ass officer. He and Gus Werner got along very well." Henriksen paused.
"Anyway, that's what I bring to the party, guys. My people and I all speak the language. We have all the contacts we need on the operational side and the industrial side. We have access to all the newest hardware. And we can be down here to assist your people in 3 or 4 days from the moment you say come."
There were no additional questions. The top cop seemed properly impressed, and the SAS major even more so.
"Thanks very much indeed for coming," the policeman said, standing. It was hard not to like the Aussies, and their country was still largely in a pristine state. A forbidding desert, most of it, into which camels had been admitted, the only place outside Arabia where they'd done well. He'd read somewhere that Jefferson Davis, of all people, had tried to get them to breed in the American Southwest, but it hadn't worked out, probably because the initial population had been too small to survive. He couldn't decide if that was bad luck or not. The animals weren't native to either country, and interfering with nature's plan was usually a bad thing to do.
On the other hand, horses and burros weren't native either. And he liked the idea of wild horses, so long as they were properly controlled by predators. No, he reminded himself, Australia wasn't really pristine, was it? Dingoes, the wild dogs of the outback, had also been introduced, and they'd killed off or crowded out the marsupial animals that belonged there. The thought made him vaguely sad. There were relatively few people here, but even that small number had still managed to upset the ecostructure. Maybe that was a sign that man simply couldn't be trusted anywhere, he thought. Even a few of them in a whole continental landmass. And so the project was needed here as well. It was a pity he didn't have more time. He wanted to see the Great Barrier Reef. An avid skin diver, he'd never made it down here with flippers and wetsuit to see that most magnificent exemplar of natural beauty. Well, maybe some day, in a few years, it would be easier, Bill thought, as he looked across the table at his hosts. He couldn't think of them as fellow human beings, could he? They were competitors, rivals for the ownership of the planet. But, unlike himself, they were poor stewards. Not all of them, perhaps. Maybe some loved nature as much as he did. But, unfortunately, there wasn't time to identify them. And so they had to be lumped together as enemies. And for that, they'd have to pay the price. A pity. Skip Bannister had been worried for some time. He hadn't wanted his daughter to go off to New York in the first place. It was a long way from Gary, Indiana. Sure, the papers said that crime was down in that dreadful city on the Hudson, but it was still too damned big and too damned anonymous for real people to live in, especially single girls. For him, Mary would always be his little girl, remembered forever as a pink, wet, noisy package in his arms, delivered by a mother who'd died 6 years later, a daughter who'd grown up needing dollhouses to be built, a series of bicycles to be assembled, clothes to be bought, an education provided for, and then finally, to his great discomfort, the little bird had finally grown her feathers and flown from the nest. For New York City, a hateful, crowded place full of hateful, obnoxious people. But he'd kept his peace on that, as he'd done when Mary had dated boys he hadn't been all that crazy about, because Mary had been as strong-willed as all girls her age tended to be. Off to make her fortune, meet Mr. Wright, or something like that. But then she'd disappeared, and Skip Bannister had had no idea what to do. It had started when she hadn't called for 5 straight days. So he'd called her New York number and let the phone ring for several minutes. Maybe she'd been out on a date, or perhaps working late. He would have tried her work number, but she'd never gotten around to giving it to him. He'd indulged her all through her life. Maybe a mistake, he thought now, or maybe not, as single fathers tended to do. But now she was gone. He'd kept calling that number at all hours of day and night, but the phone had just kept ringing, and after a week of it, he'd gotten worried. Another few days, and he'd gotten worried enough to call the police to make a missing persons report. That had been a very disagreeable event. The officer he'd finally gotten had asked all manner of questions about his daughter's previous conduct, and explained patiently after 20 minutes that, you know, young women did this sort of thing all the time, and they almost always turned up safe somewhere. Hey, you know, it's just part of growing up, proving to themselves that they're their own persons. And so, somewhere in New York was a paper file or a computer entry on one Bannister, Mary Eileen, female, missing, whom the NYPD didn't even regard as important enough for them to send an officer to her apartment on the Upper West Side to check things out. Skip Bannister had done that himself, driving in only to find a super who asked him if he was going to take his daughter's stuff out, because he hadn't seen her in weeks, and the rent would soon be due. At that point, Skip,
James Thomas, Bannister, had panicked and gone to the local police precinct station to make a report in person and demand further action, and learned that he'd come to the wrong place, but yes, they could take down a missing persons report there, too. And there, from a 50-ish police detective, he'd heard exactly the same thing he'd listened to over the phone. "Look, it's only been a few weeks. No dead female of your daughter's description has turned up. So she's probably alive and healthy somewhere. And 99 out of 100 of these cases turn out to be a girl who just wanted to spread her wings some and fly on her own, you know." "Not his, Mary," James T. Skip Bannister had replied to a calm and unlistening policeman. "Sure, they all say that. And in 99 out of 100 cases? No, you know, it's actually higher than that. That's how it turns out. And I'm sorry, but we don't have the manpower to investigate all of these cases. Sorry, but that's just how this sort of thing works. So why not just go home and wait for the phone to ring?" That he'd done, and driven all the way back to Gary in a rage that grew out of his panic, arriving finally to find 6 messages on his answering machine. And he'd run through them quickly, hoping to, but not finding one from his missing daughter. Like most Americans, James Thomas Bannister owned a personal computer, and while he'd bought it on a whim and not really used it all that much, this day, like every other, he turned it on and logged onto the net to check his email. And finally, this morning, he saw a letter in the inbox from his daughter. He moved his mouse, clicking on the letter, which sprang into life on his RGB monitor, and now he was truly panicked. She didn't know where she was? Medical experiments? Most frightening of all, the letter was disjointed and poorly written. Mary had always gotten good marks in school. Her handwriting was always neat and easy to read. Her letters had been like reading stories in the morning paper, loving, of course, and clear, concise, easy to read. This could have been written by a 3-year-old, Skip Bannister thought. Not even typed neatly, and his daughter knew how to type well. She'd gotten an A in that class. What to do now? His little girl was missing. And now his gut told him that his daughter was in danger. His stomach compressed into a knot just below his sternum. His heart speeded up. His face broke out in beads of sweat. He closed his eyes, thinking as hard as he could. Then he picked up his phone book. On the first page were the emergency numbers, from which he selected one and dialed it. "FBI?" the female voice said. "How can I help you?"
Chapter 21 Stages. The last of the winos had outlasted all predictions, but it had only prolonged the inevitable. This one was named Henry, a black man of 46 years who only appeared to be 20 years older. A veteran, he'd told everyone who'd listen, and a man with a considerable thirst, which had not, miraculously, done a great deal of liver damage. And his immune system had done a valiant job of fighting off Shiva. He was probably from the deep part of the gene pool, Dr. Kilgore thought, for what little good it had done him. It would have been useful to take a history from him, to find out how long his parents had lived. But he was too far gone by the time they'd realized it. But now the printout of his blood work said he was surely doomed. His liver had finally succumbed to the Shiva strands, and his blood chemistry was off the chart in every category that mattered. In a way, it was too bad. The doctor, still living in Kilgore, somehow wanted patients to survive. Maybe it was sportsmanship, he thought, heading down to the patient's room. "How are we doing, Henry?" the doctor asked.
"Shitty, Doc. Just shitty. Feels like my belly is coming apart inside out."
"You can feel it?" Kilgore asked. That was a surprise. He was getting nearly 12 milligrams of morphine a day now. A lethal dose for a healthy man, but the really sick ones could somehow take a lot more of the drug.